E-commerce isn't just an aspect of growing a successful wine business, it is crucial. And that's why I strongly recommend working with Offset Partners. As a proudly independent e-commerce technology and brand design company based in wine country, Offset understands the operational nuances and the customer service imperatives that distinguish a great online buying experience from a mediocre one. And that's why leading and legendary brands like Saxum, Arnott Roberts, and Kermit Lynch Wine Merchant choose Offset's proprietary commerce technology platform to power their DTC sales. If you're an allocated winery or a high-touch merchant that values an elegant, effective commerce solution for both you, your customers, and your team, reach out to the smart team at offsetpartners.com. That's OFFSET, partners with an S.com, to craft a better direct-to-consumer experience.
I'll drink to that, where we get behind the scenes of the beverage business. I'm Levy Dalton.
I'm Erin Scala.
And here's our show today. Ernest Ifkowitz of Porto Vino Selection. Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm good, Levy.
Good to see you.
Good to see you too, man.
So you're a Pennsylvania man.
I am. The Keystone State.
And what was it like growing up there?
You know, I grew up in a blue-collar neighborhood, right? I mean, dropping transmissions, fixing motorcycles. That was me, man.
What was the family like?
Man.
One of those. Yeah, I got one of those too. I also have the big Psy family.
No, in a good way too, right? You know, my dad's a biker, so he's got like biker tattoos up and down the arm. My mom was a nurse. That was kind of gives you some direction for the family. My sister was there, but I kind of gravitated towards my mom with the nursing side and taking care of people and taking care of things, and kind of wanted to be a tough guy like my dad too, right? I don't have any tattoos though, you know what I mean?
What was the relationship with beverages?
You know, my dad was he was a beer guy. So when I was a kid, he'd often ask me to go fetch him a beer. So I'd always go to the fridge and, you know, the first one I gave him, you know, I know how to serve a beer, and I'd open it and he'd say thank you. You know, when you get to the second and third one, I was like, you know, I'd shake them up a little bit, right? Just because it was fun and it'd explode. So that was that. So one day, you know, he's like, don't shake the beer up. You know, he caught me at my game. I said, listen, I want to start collecting things. He's like, why? I'm like, I just do. And he's like, here, collect this. And it was an empty beer can. Maybe it was Yingling or something like that. I'm not sure. So that was... you know, I had a little beer collection there going.
Of bottles and cans.
Bottles and cans, yeah, in my room. I mean, I wasn't drinking, you know. I was like 8 years old or something like that.
But it was about the idea of collecting.
I think so. I mean, maybe collecting would be a little bit too intellectual. I think it was the idea about those bottles were really, some of them were really different, right? Some were from Pennsylvania, but some were imports and some were, you know, they were from, you know, my dad wasn't drinking, you know, Cantillon, right? But he had some other stuff there. And so I was like, this is kind of weird. Where's this at? Even if it was from another state, you know?
Because I remember as a kid, we grew up in the sticks, like in the real sticks.
Oh, really?
It was like a logging town. Kind of similar to what you're talking
about.
Sure. Guys who drank beer and, you know, had tats and stuff. And I remember having a coin collection, just being really into the idea that these were minted in a different place. Like there was different places that they came from. There was different dates that they came from. Yeah. And, you know, that was my brush with the exotic. Like that, I'm serious. Like that, and like occasional comic books that I couldn't afford at a place that was actually called the General Store.
No way.
Yeah. There was such a place. Yeah.
Good for you, man. At least you could cash them in.
But there was a real sense that, like, you know, I was in a way kind of hunting something outside the small town of 400 people.
Dude, I remember I was looking at my collection one day at the wall, and, you know, I was starting to get a pretty good collection. And right next to the collection, it was my closet. And so I had this really good idea that I should empty out my closet and that could be my office, right? For the beer can collection. So I did that and, you know, I started putting some books in there, you know, a little light candle. That probably wasn't a good idea. My dad's like, what's going on, man? And that was like, you know, I was still trying to be a grease monkey, but my dad's like, he's doing things in the closet, you know?
Did you have hangout time with dad? I mean, was it a close relationship or?
No, I think it was a close relationship, but my dad's still alive. But he was really my hero. I mean, he was a real tough guy, and you know, I like to think I'm a tough guy, but I don't think I am. You know.
Right.
He was a real tough guy. You know. I mean, like guns, knives, tattoos, kind of tough guy. So,
well, I remember you told me the story, like somebody was honking at him and he got in a car and he said, like, there's a kid in the car. And
oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
He, like, shut him down.
Yeah, we were, like, going for milk, right? And he's like, get in the car. We're going to go for milk. You know, you get a gallon of milk, which.
Well, you're forgetting my favorite quote.
What's
which
that?
Is like, let's get the fuck out of here. He's like, all right, so let's get the fuck out of here. Let's go for some quart of milk.
Yeah, he's a character, man. He's a character. And he was a guy that never had any fear, you know? Never had any fear. And that was always at once mythical to me as a kid, but also really put me in a position where it's hard to be that person. And of course, as you grow up later in life, you realize that, you know, he has fears like the rest of us. But it gave me this idea of, like, you know, I've always been interested in mythical people, you know, Odysseus or Beowulf, stuff like that. And I think that maybe that, yeah, thinking about it now, maybe that did transfer to me too, you know, a little bit, my own little tough guy way, right? Kind of going down my own trail.
That's funny because I identify with a lot of that.
Oh,
like,
yeah?
Yeah, yeah. Like as a kid, I would take classes that were clearly not my wheelhouse, like how to fix cars and stuff. And I would do terribly at them. Like really bad. It was like the only D I ever got. Like right. I was a straight A student just by just definite. Like I just didn't have to do anything to get A's. Like
right,
it just came naturally. And I would take these classes that were like tough guy classes. You know, I would see these guys like working on their car and stuff. And I would like want to be one of the tough guys.
Yeah, they had like big belts and stuff, you know.
You know, like I wanted this idea of manhood kind of thing. And I would like take these classes and like try to hang with those dudes. And both of those things failed miserably.
Yeah. No, I hear you. I hear you. Same boat, man.
That same thing with kind of oversized male heroes. Like in terms of I got really into Greek myths, like in a big way. And I got into comic books. And
like, you know, that epic journey, right? And that epic hero. And they're... You know, those guys are always traveling, you know? They kind of have to go to a foreign land and come back or something like that, you know? But, you know, my dad, even to this day, I'm like, I'm going to New York. You know, he lives in Pennsylvania. He's like, whoa, I ain't going there. I'm like, well, Dad, it's New York. He's like, no way. I'm a smart man.
You got out of the small town, and what happened? I mean, what kind of segued? I mean, now you're this big globe-charting Italian wine importer. So, like,
oh, yeah,
what's
man.
The
it's a
vague...
lifestyle.
But what's the arc of that? I mean...
You know, I think the arc of that was really just being curious from that beginning beer collection, or you had that coin collection. Is just kind of... I don't know. I felt something inside. I just wanted that sense of adventure, of kind of going down... a different path, or just any path, you know, not to be different, to be different, because that can be lonely too. And so I started reading a lot. I didn't know about college. I went to a high school that kind of, you know, there was the blue collar section, and then across the train tracks, there were, you know, the kids that, you know, they knew who Beowulf was at that time. And I was just kind of figuring it out myself. And so I started reading lots of books. And at the same time, you know, high school ended, and I had to do something, right? And my dad's like, well, don't overthink it. Get a job. And so I thought about it a lot. And I started waiting tables, like many of us, right? That, you know, lots of young people I see today, they're really into wine because they wait tables. And of course, they're much better than I am and I ever was. But you start, you know, waiters tend to drink some wine at the end of the shift. You know, I mean, I did. So
for me, culture was something I felt denied of. And that I felt like I had to fight to get. So for me to read like a book that had something to do with Beowulf or Odysseus, that felt for me like almost not a rebellious act, but like at that limit of it. Like
For me, it was rebellious.
Yeah.
For me, it was rebellious. But I felt stupid too, right? I mean, I was so rebellious, I didn't want to read the introductions. But, you know, I'm like reading the first paragraph 10 times. I'm like, okay. I'm all about the trail, but I'm still lost and I'm at the beginning. This isn't good. But it did teach me to be okay with being lost and lost for a long time and even to be bumbling and insecure. And I think that's helped me. I think that's helped me later. Not always. Sometimes it's better to be secure. But I, that idea of not reading introductions, that idea of, you know, I started trying to learn Latin a little bit. And, you know, I didn't know what an adverb was, dude. I was using like Mad Lib books, right? So that was an important time for me. And it really created a habit for me to try your best. You know, when you're lost, you don't have to be found. You don't have to capture something. You don't have to know it all right away. You know, you don't have to have that tasting note. I still feel that today. Some of the wines that I really like in the portfolio, you know, some wines you just taste, you're like, yeah, that's it. You know, let's figure out how to make it work. And some, you're like, I'm not sure. And I still feel that way. And I think that's, those are some of the wines that actually tend to be wines that I really like in the long term, you know?
Early in, the things that kind of kept me in like restaurants and wine were like some of the friend groups that were involved. Like just there was a camaraderie.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, when I was waiting tables, there wasn't a wine scene, but there was that camaraderie of, you know, at the end of the shift going out for a couple of drinks together. I miss that. I mean, I have a family now and it's different as it should be. But I do miss those days of saddling up to the bar and talking about the shift. And we didn't talk so much about wines, but a little bit you did, right? And that was a nice balance. I not to be overly romantic, but I enjoy that rhythm.
We're probably about the same age, so I imagine that some of the wines that were kind of like really expensive now, back then, you know, a little more affordable. Maybe somebody could afford them, have it with dinner kind of thing.
Oh, for sure. I worked in downtown Princeton at a restaurant called Meditera, and it opened up, and you know, there was lots of Italian, lots of French, even some Spanish stuff, and so it was easy to explore, and that is really important to me. I mean, when I go looking for wines in portfolio, just for me at least, I would never want you know a big roller luxury portfolio because I couldn't offer that to people like me that were getting started out. You know what I mean? I'm all about like putting some money down for a wine and also having them in the portfolio. And I think that's an important direction. But I also like, you know, offer that kid in Nebraska who's waiting tables, you know, a wine for $14 or $12, you know?
It's interesting that you say that because I know talking to you that you're really interested in what I think of as kind of like the other alternative markets outside of San Francisco and New York. Like I know that you really like to go to some of the you know, smaller towns of the United States and meet some kid that's just kind of needs direction and kind of work with that person almost more than you enjoy like getting that placement at the high profile place in Manhattan. It seems to me.
For sure. On an emotional level, for sure. I mean, one operates at many different levels, but on an emotional level, for sure. You know, I was recently in Houston and there was, a sommelier who, you know, was fighting the fight, you know? He was putting out the wines that he really liked, buying from cool, small distributors. And he just was filled with so much optimism and so many questions for me. And we talked about this a lot because Houston can be a luxury market. And he, like I, really find ourselves in both of these worlds. You know, you kind of get a little bit, got to put one foot in bed with the devil, right? And we're okay with that with the luxury market. And we enjoy some of those wines. But there is the thing of we want to keep it exploring, especially in Italy. You know, Italy, I think, different than France. It's about the exploring, right? Italy's the great country of weekend trips. you can hop on a train or a plane and get somewhere real quickly. And I think that's charming and romantic. And I want to keep that.
You know, it's not a normal transition, the one that you made from not originally going to college to learning Latin and then teaching that to teachers. That seems like something must have happened there.
I've always had relationships with people where they were the teacher and I was the student, or I was the teacher and they were the student. And the best of those relationships, it kind of went back and forth a little bit. Who was who? And I think those are the relationships I learned the most from. So for me, it in some ways felt a lot more natural than maybe for somebody else.
That's interesting. Coming back to your family stuff, what's like different views of your dad? Feels like at different moments, even maybe in the same day, your thought about him kind of moved.
Yeah, it has. And it has over the years, as we all do with our parents. But my context has changed. And so it's allowed me to be a lot gentler to myself and for him to be a lot gentler to himself and me. And that's been great. And it's been something that has happened because I've, you know, because I do live in Italy and I do something totally different than what my dad did growing up.
And so what was the first trip to Italy?
You know, back then, geez, the first trip is a long time ago. The first trip was I got a job teaching Latin. So I came out of college. I got a job at a high school teaching Latin. So they signed me up. You know, I had some money, right? I had some money saved up so I could go for the summer. Got to Italy and I wanted, you know, it's kind of like throwing a dart at a map. Where do you go, right? So I went to Florence, the same place that I have to kind of elbow the tourists out of the way to get my Lampredotto sandwich in the morning. And I wanted to see Botticelli's, don't laugh, but I wanted to see Botticelli's La Nascita di Venere, the birth of Venus. I read about that and I thought it'd be cool to see it. But I like that. I like that mix, you know, of being a little bit bumbling, being a little bit naive too, and also be thoroughly searching and trying to understand something on a deep level.
So what was that first trip like? I mean, now that you look back at it.
I spent a lot of time alone, you know, in the city, just walking around, and I loved it. I loved looking up at those medieval rafters and walking along the shade of buildings. That was cool for me. I mean, this was all new for me, and these were real new emotions. You know, I was doing a little bit of translation work for some poetry work, my own edification. I was into a couple poets that were in Italian, you know, and I wanted to do that. I was doing a little bit of Latin, and I was just taking lots of long walks, you know. It was a long time ago, but it was a good time. You know, I was melancholy, and I like melancholy, but you can get lonely too, right? So I was like, okay, where are the girls and beaches, right? So I went to Elba. You know, you take the train, then you take the ferry, and it was so cool, right? It was so cool, and I got to Elba. I didn't know where I was going. I had almost no money. I met some people. I'm like, listen. I was looking at any places around here. And again, I was speaking English. I didn't know Italian at the time. And they're like, oh, well, we'll take you. Where are you going? I'm like, bah, your direction. And to remember the smell of like rosemary and dried fennel, like classic Elba smells. And, you know, we're driving. And I think there was like Pinback. Some music Pinback. There was some kind of American music called Pinback. There might have been a box cello violin, the Paolo Casales thing. So there's like these two things going on, like this American punk, which I don't know punk really, and this great classical music. And again, this dichotomy that I had and I still have in my life between maybe blue collar, rough and ready, and something more intellectual and deeply searching. Anyway, so they're like, you know, it's hot. I'm like, yeah, it's hot. I'm like, you know, is there, thank God I didn't say, is there a pool around here, right? They're like, yeah, there's, you know, you jump in the Mediterranean. So I remember floating in the Mediterranean with them. I'm like, well, let's just go, you know, jump right in the beach. I love how Italians are like that. I love it. I mean, of course, if your life is just being frivolous, no go. But we all need that. And so I was in the water and we're all just hanging out. And I said, these people, this is amazing. They don't even know me. I think I said the classic American thing. I could be a serial killer. And, you know, thankfully they didn't understand. And I was floating in the Mediterranean. I just felt I was on top of the world, man.
When did food become important to you?
My parents would cook a lot. So, you know, there was always the crock pot, right? So, I mean, I remember that my dad would always make a pork and sauerkraut crock pot. So as a kid, food was a bit a part of my life. And then, of course, when you get into restaurants, food takes on the centerpiece because that's what you're offering to people, right? And so sometimes people don't like what you're offering and you can eat it in the back. And and so that was a way to discover food too. But it wasn't that really food became such a deep part of me until I went to Italy. Still to this day, a normal Italian just has a sensibility about food that at least I didn't have, you know, growing up. I guess everyone, people are different nowadays, but then I didn't have that kind of sensibility. I remember when I was in Florence, those first couple months before I went to Elba, I had to eat, and I couldn't go out to eat every meal. So I went to the market and, you know, you're kind of trying out some words, please, all that. I got some olive oil and ricotta and pasta. I just remember sitting in my room reading poetry, and that olive oil, that ricotta, the cream, the yogurt, you know, it was another register for me. And so that opened the floodgates. And I mean, it's always been like that. And now with my family and having a son and seeing him growing up with this kind of food, it's reinforced that.
That must be interesting, you know, given your childhood to be a father and raise a child in a whole other country, given what you've already said.
Yeah, I wasn't planning on having a kid. And that said, my son is a really, really important part of my life. You know, all around me is a country called Italy, and they speak Italian. But my son and I, we speak English. So we have this kind of bubble around us because we only speak English. I mean, it's good for talking bad about people too, right? I mean, it's made me think about America a lot in my childhood, which I think all fathers do, right? And then you want to give your kid what you had, right? So, you know, if you threw the baseball with dad and that was kind of cool before the turkey dinner, you want to give that to your kid. And, you know, I couldn't find a baseball glove and bat there. And, you know, certainly no one else was doing it. And so the experiences that I had as a kid that I thought that I should give to my son weren't on offer. But other ones were. So, you know, cooking spaghetti. My son knows how to make spaghetti al pomodoro. Probably better than me in his head. Before I left, I took the day off and I'm like, dude, let's cook up some spaghetti al pomodoro. It's the typical guy thing you do, right? It's like, mom's not home, like, you know, and you get a lot, you get like double, right? You just make a big plate of it. You just be a pig. It's great. And I'm like, well, what do you want to put in? And he's like, well, pomodoro. I'm like, oh, okay, yeah. Well, what else? I'm like, we got some anchovies, some capers, some olives, some tuna. He's like, no, you're too complicated. Just salt, tomatoes, pomodoro, and at the end, a little bit of olive oil on top. And maybe we'll have cheese. I was like, dude, you're Italian.
Yeah, this guy's, it's over.
Exactly. I was like, in Italian, you say americanata when you make like a, you know, you add like 50 ingredients, you know, a kind of bombastic creation. So
you ended up making Florence your home. And what's your impression of it now? Because I find that, you know, when you go back to a place that you have that kind of really opening experience and then you go back and live there, a lot can change for you.
As an expat, you go through phases, right? So at first you love Europe, right? You're a European and those Americans should, you know, if they only could understand like what a Speedo could do, right? And then, you know, you're not making any money after a couple of years and you're like these Euro trash people, right? the cars are too small. And a lot of people flit back and forth between those, you know, love and hate feelings living in another culture. And, you know, Florence isn't in the middle of nowhere, right? I live in a small hill town about 20 minutes south of Florence, but I go to Florence a lot. And, you know, you see lots of tourists, right? I mean, I know lots of places to go where the tourists are not, but you can't get out of the way of them sometimes, right? And I used to have the feeling, you know, they're kind of annoying, you know? I'm like, don't say bruschetta to me, you know, five more times, you know? It's bruschetta. Don't say, oh, isn't it beautiful here? But those are the same things I did when I came years ago. And so it's only been the last couple of years, but I've had a real a real softness for just normal bumbling tourists, you know. And they often think I'm Italian, which is ironical. I tell them, I know I'm from America, but I live here, and I'm kind of happy to help them. And I'm even happy to listen to their little piece of authenticity, because you can't tell people what authenticity is for them, you know.
It seems like that's a topic you've searched out without really saying it up front. But like, if I'm trying to hang out with a lot of blue collar dudes and I'm trying to hang out with a lot of poets,
yeah,
usually I think at the root of that, I'm looking for something to be overly trite, authentic. The part that about Ernest that I don't see is the part where you were like hanging out at the mall next to the Gap store. You never did the middle road.
No, for you sure, man. I mean, my wife calls me Barone Barbone, which means Barone is barren, right? And Barbone is like a clochard, like a homeless guy, right? So that's me. Like, I can eat the prosciutto sandwich in the car, get drunk, and fall asleep. I mean, get drunk with a good bottle of wine. Or I can do like the 3-star Michelin thing, right? I'm good with both. Authenticity is tricky. You know, it's a tricky subject. And so, again, I don't think it's my role to tell people what is authentic. You know, it's kind of a version of a tastemaker. And I think lots of us are looking for authenticity in wines, right? I mean, in life too, but it comes up in the wines all the time. Oh, this is really authentic. I'm not sure. It's a slippery word, isn't it? It's a slippery word.
Especially now it's been like commoditized. I mean, now it's like actively marketed for, you know?
Yeah. But I do think that, you know, when something's authentic to you, you feel it. The trick is you can't tell people your feelings of authenticity and expect them to have the same one. Kind of like my son, right? I can't throw a football with him and expect it's going to be the same feelings I had throwing a football with my dad. I mean, I don't think he really threw footballs. I mean, it was like we were throwing knives, right? But, and so I can't tell a wine drinker, no, this is what a Sangiovese is like. You know, it's like the forest floor, and you know, it's rough and ready, but it has a touch of class too. A great Chianti, or you know, something from Rado or Lamole, or a bruschetta that only has olive oil on it and salt. They have to figure that on their own, but they can be inspired by your authenticity. You know what I mean? Like it has. This is too many big words together, but like the fecundity of your authenticity, right? Like people get excited and thirsty, hopefully too, right? About what you think is authentic, and then they find their own authenticity. And that might be that same bottle of wine, it might be a different bottle of wine, or you know, they might change the tables and say like, "Here, your authenticity, you know, check this out, man." And that's happened to me too.
Well, I've definitely seen that develop, you know, in the culture in New York, at least.
Oh yeah,
where people one up you on the authentic. Yeah, I think once you set an ideal in place, someone is usually going to come in and be like, well, I got one that's a little more tight.
Sure. Yeah, it's a contact sport sometimes, so a little bit like that, you know? But if that's what it's all about, and you're not really looking for, you know, Venice beauty or like damn good, delicious wines that are unique, then I think we're all just, you know, it's a little bit too much posturing for me.
So when did you move to Florence?
So 2008, I moved back with my wife, and we had a son, and that's when I started Portovino.
So did you have some experience in the wine trade before you started your own business?
I would like to say yes. But, you know, I think I smoked that pipe, you know. I'm a romantic at heart, and I didn't have any kind of professional experience. But I would go and I'd taste a lot of wines and go to these wineries and talk with these producers. And that was a really good time for me, you know, just spending time talking with people. And my Italian was getting, you know, much better then. It wasn't great, but I was understanding, you know, like 80-90%. But it set up a pattern to talk to people and to be patient with people, and to be patient for the story. And that's good, man. That's like, you know, I'm not a patient guy, right? So I think that's really good. But at some point, I realized I had to get some experience. So I had a friend in Siena. I lived in Siena as well. They had a friend from Oakland, from the East Bay. And he had a little wine shop, European-centered. And I got a job there for about 3 years. It was a great time. It let me taste other wines. It was good. And I worked for a small importer. You know, I helped a small importer with his business. So those two jobs, you know, I packed it all together, right? I'm like, okay, I got 3 years. I still wanted to be an importer. I didn't even know it was called an importer. I just wanted to, you know, I wanted to find wines and bring them over. I didn't know it was called importer. I didn't understand the rock star element importer to it. And those 3 years, I had two jobs. I was working at a small wine shop, and I was helping a small Italian importer.
Oh, wait. Kind of an interesting time to start a business.
Oh, yeah. It was really cool. Yeah. you know, when you like stare at those profit and losses, yeah, the colors don't change, you know. It was tough. But it made me figure out quickly what I really wanted to do.
So what was that? I mean, what came to the fore right away for you?
That it's serious. It's not a game. So you can be hopelessly romantic, and you can be searching, and you can have epic ideals of authenticity, but you got to make the nuts and bolts of the business work. And you know, we don't often talk about that, but I wasn't good at that. You know what I mean, Levy? I was, you know, I was like, you know, I wasn't a business guy. I didn't even like money. I was like, the less the better. People were like, okay. so money wasn't in my world. And that was really hard for me in the beginning. But I buckled down. I said, this is important to me. It's not about the money. It's about the responsibility. It's about, I look these producers in the eyes, and you got to pay them, and you got to find the money to do that. I look customers in the eyes, right, when I come here. And I took it seriously. And I tried my best, and you know, I was lucky too. I you know, I think a lot of people do what I do and aren't lucky or don't get the business point down, and that's a problem.
When you look at your own career as a wine importer now that it's like 8 years old.
Sure.
I mean, do you see different parts of your progression there? Do you identify different evolution?
You know, I said I worked at a small wine shop. A guy that I worked with there was Mark. And so Mark came on about 4 years ago, and you know, he's going to places like Tennessee and you know, Chicago, and he's built up this distributor network. And so that's been a really big deal, you know. I mean, we're still a small medium importer, but we're not, you know, selling most of our stuff in New York or San Francisco or Los Angeles. We're really trying to spread the love to all these other places and give love to these other places. So that's been one big evolution and an important one. Both the philosophy that I have and Mark has for Porto Vino to bring good wines to lots of other people. And then also economically, right? I mean, you know, don't they say something like New York is where you start and end the business or something like that? I think that might be true for a lot of people, right? A lot of people start it up and end it. And it's really sad. They put their whole heart and spirit into things and, you know, went to shit. Having these other markets, I think we're up to 22 states, has been a balance. And it's also been a financial backboard for us to do better things, find cooler wines, spend more time understanding wines, find and understand regions. Another evolution for me personally is the relationship with producers. In the beginning, this word romantic comes up, but you know, you sit at the table and everyone's smiling, they're bringing out the older wines and everything's good. And I think that's really important. It's kind of like when you meet a guy or a girl, right? You should kind of enjoy each other. And there is a courtship there. You try to put some money together to go out to eat maybe somewhere. And then there's the period where you're like, you know, who the fuck's taking out the trash tonight, right? And it's just normal. If you have real relationships and spend enough time with people, you go through that, you know? You say, you know, first everything's great. Then they're like, you know, they need money or they need to sell more wine or they want to sell wine you don't like or you want to sell wine that they don't have, right? And a lot of people stay, what I see is a lot of people stay at that phase where it's like a death by a thousand cuts, right? And that's fine. I mean, we all have those relationships and they're mutually beneficial. But I think the best relationship is where you get beyond those two stages, just like a marriage. And I'm not saying I'm the ideal here, right? Because I'm not, unfortunately. But you got to like kissing your wife or your husband, right? And you got to know when it's your fucking day to take out the trash.
In terms of developing other markets, that's interesting to me because I think for a lot of the kind of small scale or smaller scale producers you work with in Italy, my instinct would be like, well, you could probably just sell all of that in New York and San Francisco. Like, they don't make a lot of wine. But you're actively saying like, look, no, we're going to try to develop this base of all these other states.
Yes and no, right? I mean, when we talk about producer size, I think that we just say small or big, you know? There's lots of medium-sized producers that I think are really interesting. And, you know, sometimes the middle road's the harder one to pave because it you don't understand it quickly. You can understand small producer. You can understand big producer. You don't know what middle producer means. I think producers that have 10 hectares, 15 hectares, even 20. I mean, you know, Walter Mauss has 20 hectares. It allows him to have a lot of different tanks. You know, I can taste through those tanks. We can choose the best wines to put in their Dona, right? I think that's really cool. So I think some of our producers are medium-sized producers. They have 10 hectares. They have 15 hectares. And so there is a real need to distribute those wines nationally. And I love that need. I it's easy or easier, I think, to be the cool kid that sells 20 cases of this weird-ass wine variety, right, in New York City. That's not elevating the wine consciousness of the sommelier community and the buyer community for Italian wine. With the smaller producers, it's trickier. It's a little bit like a puzzle, you know? I think you have to connect people to people. So you just don't take, you know, I have producers that we have a palette of or two palettes of, and I just don't think you put it in one market. I don't think you put it in, you know, 20 some markets. But I do think you make connections maybe in three or four. And so you have this really cool Sangiovese, you know, from Colipisani. And he's only got, you know, two palettes a year. But this Sangiovese is delicious when lots of other stuff is kind of like, meh. And, you know, the guys in North Carolina, they're digging it, right? And they take their palette. And then, you know, guys in Miami, Florida, to your surprise, are digging it too. And you give them their palate. And I think that's a real service. And you tell the producer, you know, they kind of, you know, Italians aren't very good with geography. They still think Miami's really close to New York. I mean, have you seen this?
No.
They're like, let's go to Miami after New York. I'm like, well, you know, we got to get a flight. Or they're like, how about, you know, upstate New York, right? And we can just take a cab there, you know, to Rochester. I'm like, well, I'm not sure, right? So I don't know if I answered your question, but that for me has been the arc of, especially in the last 4 years of Porto Vino. You know, we're cranking now. It's great. It's really cool. And it gives you the opportunity, you know, it gives the opportunity when you're practical, when you get your shit together to really in some ways be more sensitive again and a different kind of sensitivity, right? And that's, and I'm just coming into this and it's really exciting for me, you know. It's easy to lose your sensitivity, isn't it? Right? I mean, it's easy to be hopelessly romantic sensitive and go out of business. It's easy to be like a numbers guy, crunch it and, you know, crush it. that's not, that both of those aren't me and who I want to be. I want to make things work and, you know, I want to try to be sensitive to find cool wines.
So you have the latitude now to...
It's starting, you know, it's starting. It's still tough, right? I mean, no, it takes a lot of work. It's just starting for me after a long, long time. But I recognize how important it is because I think for a while there, years ago, you go into emergency mode and you're just kind of, you know, a producer wants to sell you some wine that you don't necessarily think is great or really fits in your portfolio, where they want you to sell, you know, three times as much in 1 year. It's easy to be dismissive of them and say like, well, you don't understand, or this is why, and understand it. And I tend to have less conversations like that. I tend to say like, I understand where you're coming from, right? Or tell me about like things that are going on there, your economic problems, or how can we figure it out? Or how can I help you here? Or let me explain this guy that's calling you from, you know, this other distributor's calling, you know, maybe that is a good option. Let's play it through. So I feel better. I sleep better at night like that.
So obviously I get it that you live in Italy and also that you speak Italian, but is there a particular reason why you've only done Italian wines? You know, because a lot of portfolios, once they start with a part of Europe, they expand.
Sure. It's a good question. You know, as we've grown, as Porto Vino's grown, I've often thought, is there another country to do, right? I mean, you know, Portugal's really cool. Mark, who works with me, is fluent in Spanish and knows Spanish wines really well. Greece ain't a bad place to go on vacation with the family and do a little bit of wine work. You know what I'm saying? But I don't feel that I can do the same service for people. Do you know what I mean? I can't tell them the same stories. It feels more like a sip and spit importer, you know? So I can go to Portugal, sip and spit, but I don't know the language. It took me years to know the language intimately. You know, it's one thing saying ciao and un café, right? It's another thing like saying to the barista, listen, why'd you serve me this café in a paper cup? I need it in ceramic and give me a shortfall. You know what I mean? And so that's you know, what I can offer to people, you know? It's a service industry. I'm serving people wine. I still think of it that way. And then I'm also telling them the stories and the authentic stories of a place. And I just can do that. I can do that better in Italy. I don't know where I can do that elsewhere, you know? Also time-wise, I'm not going to go to France and go to a natural wine fair. I mean, I love the Loire Valley wines just as much as the next guy, but I don't live in the Loire Valley. I don't take trains, there every week and meet with producers. I mean, and that's what I do in Italy. And that's, you know, you got to spend the time, do the work. And I just don't see me doing it in all these places.
And what's it like doing the work, you know, based in Italy and then selling in the States? Because it's not everybody, right? Like, there's plenty of people who live in the States and import wine to the States.
Now, I remember everyone in the beginning, they were like, good idea, man. Sell to the U.S. wine market, but you know, be in a medieval castle in Italy, that's going to work out. You know, kind of the, you got to go to the cow to milk it kind of thing, you know? And they were right. I mean, in the beginning, it was really hard. It's hard to, you know, with the time difference, to cold call top San Francisco restaurants, be like, hey, man, I was just wondering, I got this Vermentino from Sardinia, native rootstock. But as time's gone on, I think people are looking for someone that really is discovering producers that maybe don't come to the fairs, or that you need to follow before you bring them over, or they just want to know, you know, where to go out to eat. You know, I plan so many trips for people. It's not like I don't wine and dine them. You know, we go out to eat maybe a meal or two, then I drop them off at a train station, then I make sure they get to somewhere else. I mean, that's been a big part. I think everyone has their own, not everyone, but lots of people have their own story with Italy. And I respect that, and I want them to continue that story. If I can help them go this way or other way, then I feel like I'm doing a real service to the community as a whole. And then just by default, I'm doing a service to Portovino, right?
And so what did the portfolio look like originally? Because I feel like when I've gone to the tasting more recently, it's a lot more wine than it was originally the case. So I imagine there's been some growth.
There's lots of growth. Lots of growth. In the beginning, I was lucky to, I think I started with two key producers, Walter Massa and Alice. I mean, those were the two that, you know, gave us stability to go out there in the market. Super rare grape, you know, you know Tamarasso. That was a hard sell. I thought everyone knew it. You know, at the time, Walter was even then, he was really famous. I mean, politicians would be coming by his house, all kinds of wine lovers. So I'm like, okay, so here I am. They're like, you know, Timahoo? and there were some people in the New York market that knew it. And maybe two in San Francisco, but except for that, no one. But I believed in this winery and it worked. You know, I started bringing it around. It's still to this day, it was one of the success stories of a white that is not a cheap Italian white that we don't sell 20 cases of. And I'm really proud of that. It's entered into the minds of sommeliers and stuff. So that was one. The other one was a wine that I didn't want to import at all, right? Because I wanted the cool shit. Like, I wanted it to be weird. It was, you know, I wanted it to be the anti-importer, you know? good business plan, you know? Good way to make money. in fact, my investor would always say, he's like, you were going to make money on that? Or how's that work, you know?
So you're saying you didn't want to have a Prosecco is what you're saying.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But I do believe if you know what you're searching for, you're not searching. And so you have to always be on the lookout for, you know, for things that they get you excited, you know, part of selling wine, part of getting the wine out there is being excited about it, for sure. It's a very simple emotion, but it's a very important emotion. And so I wanted some Jura, right? So I wanted some Jura from Chateau Chalon. I had to find the distributor of it in Italy. And it happened to be in
Vittorio Veneto. You wanted to buy it to drink.
Yeah, yourself. To drink. Yeah, yeah. Right. So I took the train up to Vittorio Veneto. It's this area right near the Dolomite part of the Prosecco zone. Which before that, of course, you know, I was never there, and so I used to talk shit about it. I'd be like, it's an industrial wasteland, you know. and it wasn't. It was beautiful. Rolling hills and the Dolomites, dude. I mean, the Dolomites are right there. Alpine lakes. And she got me the wines, and she said, would you like a glass of Prosecco? I said, okay, it's hot out, right? Be nice. So I took a glass of Prosecco, and it was a Brut Prosecco. And at that time, Brut wasn't the thing. You know, everyone wanted extra dry, especially abroad, but also in Italy. And it was delicious. It was delicious. And I said, is this Prosecco? Because I just want to be clear here. I don't like Prosecco.
You felt yourself falling for it?
Exactly. Yeah. I was like, you know, I don't want this. You know, she played my game. She's like, she understood, right? She got it. I was the guy that was drinking Cremant, right? From Loire, not Prosecco. I knew what I was doing, you know? But that Prosecco just turned me. And it was the beginning of a relationship that really made a difference for Porto Vino. And also the portfolio, because it's just not, you know, when people say it's just, you know, it's easy to say our portfolio is just filled with geeky stuff, you know, but it's not. It's also, by default in some ways, a rediscovering of the classics. Like, I'm really proud that we discovered a Prosecco that, you know, my wine geek friends like and drink and I can serve at home. That means a lot to me. Of course, how I got it was was a bit odd. So she said, she told me to come back. So I went home and I said, now I'm interested, right? So now you got me. I mean, this is really good. I said, can I come back up? And I'd like to taste through all the Prosecco. And she was with an importer. They were doing okay, but they didn't understand what she had. And so she was at the end of that relationship. I think that importer went under. And I went back up, and it was a pretty formal meeting. There are two women are the owners of the winery, Cinzia and Pia Francesca. And, you know, they're serious ladies. You know, they're cellar rats, but, you know, they dress well. they're articulate, and, you know, they know what they want. They, you know, it's not just by chance that they make very stellar sparkling wines. And so we're tasting, and I'm enjoying all. And I said, this is a big deal. This means a lot to me. These are great. These are great. And I said, you know, God, there's this thing in here. It reminds me of my childhood. And I love that. I think we all love that, you know, taste it. Remind you of your childhood when you go back. And when I was a kid, I used to ride my bike down the sidewalk to a honeysuckle bush. And I remember I hated that bush because you had to like squeeze. You get like one drop of honeysuckle, right? And I would do that for hours. Of course, like, you know, thank God my dad never, like, you know, found me. Like, what the hell are you doing, dude? The neighbors are like, you're at the honeysuckle bush, one drop at a time.
Kick your ass.
Kick your ass.
That's when he stopped playing catch with him. He's exactly. Like, I'm ashamed to even be seen exactly. with you.
Exactly.
No more catch with you.
But I, you know, they're, you know, and Prosecco, the Gloria grape has that honeysuckle. It's kind of a classic descriptor for Prosecco, even in the Brut. I said, you know, suckle is to suck is sukya, right? And I looked at these women in both in the eyes and I said, yeah, honeysuckle, you know, it's, you know, sukya tete, which means like suck your breasts, right? And they're like,
I'm sure your dad would have been proud of that.
I think he would have been good with that one.
That's my little man.
I think he was good.
All grown up now.
And, you know, they were stone-faced. And, of course, you know, the next day, I didn't realize it, right? I didn't realize I was being Romulus, right?
Next day you were, like,
with a dual G. They're like, okay, this guy's, yeah. And so the next day, I was, you know, write a formal email and say, like, let's get it going. She's like, container order payment in advance. I mean, she probably was trying to get rid of me, right? And I said, yeah, okay. And I did it. And I you know, we could have lost everything then. But I believed in it. And you know, we were a smaller company. I shouldn't have been ordering a container of Prosecco that wasn't tested in the market and everything. But I did it. And I used the money and I paid her. And we sold it. And people enjoyed it. And we ordered more. And it worked out. And to this day, Cinzia loves that story. Loves that I said that to them. And and it's something that brings us closer together. You know, relationships are hard. And so when you have those moments that are real, that are intimate, you know, when you're fighting or something's not working out or there's a problem, you know, quirks go bad, dude. But, you know, sometimes there are 200-300 cases that are gone bad. And you don't just say, that's your problem, right? You say, well, how can we fix this? Those kind of stresses and those kind of conversations really come much easier to me because of this openness that I've had with producers and these stories that we've had together.
I feel like Walter Musso is a guy that's known to be a big personality.
Crazy.
And that's one of your other early finds. So, I mean, there had to be some similar level of miscommunication.
I was definitely intimidated, right? But I went to his house and I said, you know, can I come in? And he said, what do you want to drink? And to this day, Walter still says that. I mean, I've been to Walter's house hundreds of times and he's like, what do you want to drink? And, I mean, he can be very direct sometimes. And I said, Tamarazzo. So I was off to a good start. And we started tasting through some bottles. And then he said, okay, let's go downstairs. And so, you know, he still lives with his mom in the same house. And then downstairs is the cellar. And so we went downstairs and, you know, there were all these cement tanks of Tamarazzo. And we started tasting from the cement tanks. And it was really the first time. I didn't have a lot of experience tasting from tanks so much, right? Unfinished wines. And then we start tasting from big barrels, the Monreale, his Barbera. And then, you know, he's like, all right, let's go for a ride over to the vineyard. So we went over to the vineyards and the vineyards were like 2 minutes away. And we're looking at the vineyards and not talking about soil. I mean, you know, he wasn't polished. You know, I like to say he's a normal guy. He's not. But I think he still has those aspirations to be a normal guy, even though he makes this great wine. And so, you know, then we go out to dinner and hang out. And I just spent hours with him, right? And he shouldn't have given me that. I didn't deserve that. There were much better importers than to take that. And they could have done probably a better job, too. I mean, that's the truth. But I said, well, can we start? And he said, I don't know. And I said, okay, well, why don't you think about it? He goes, okay, I thought about it. Let's start. Let's see how it goes. I was like, yeah. And I was super psyched. I was super scared, though, too. I wouldn't do a good job for him. I worked really hard. And I think we all did. Worked really hard to make it happen. And you know, the wines come through, you know. So that was Walter. I mean, you know, and then, of course, Walter's this crazy personality. And he can, you know, he can start yelling and stuff. And he can also be a gentle soul. So that relationship has been, you know, it was hard in the beginnings because he didn't know what he wanted, right? And he had a lot of things going on. Again, there's always the story behind the story. People nowadays, they love going to Walter Moss when I take him there because he's the crazy professor and all that. You know, it plays well. And he is that. I mean, that is a part of him. But there's the story behind the story, too. Walter really is married to those hills. I mean it. Like, that's his wife, those hills. And Tamarazzo is his sweetheart. And that's the way he feels deep inside. And, you know, when you talk to him more and more, a guy that rescued a grape like that, he's not a big blowhard, right? He's not a mad professor. He's not stupid. He's not crazy. He's just really passionate and set on doing something. And so I think that was cool. I think that's a good time. Walter always says, quotes Dasky Rossi. He says, tutto un equilibrio sopra la follia. Everything's is a balance above the craziness. And that's Walter. That is Walter. He's crazy, crazy, but he has this impeccable balance above that craziness. And he has a good dose of what they say in Italian, buon senso, like common sense. He's, you know, I remember when we went to the co-op and they wanted to talk to me. This was years later and in the local area. And they wanted to use native yeast and they wanted to close the top of the Barbera tank. They wanted to, not open top fermentation. And Walter's like, I don't know why you guys are doing that. You know, I do open top fermentation. It works all the time. We have grapes right next to each other. That's crazy. But they were used to doing it their own way. And they lost that like simple thing of like buon senso, of common sense, you know? So that's Walter. Yeah.
I think a lot of times when I think of the Portovino book, although it's maybe less true now, but I often think of it as like, they found the classic producer that had been doing it the same way for 50 or 100 years, but like had fallen off the radar and people didn't really know about. And they tracked this dude down, sometimes like living in a cave. And
for sure. I mean, I think I'm fascinated by finding these producers, and I feel it. I don't laugh at this, but I feel it as a moral obligation sometimes. You know, these things are fragile; they go away. Producers go away. And you don't see him again. I mean, that was the case with Scarpa. Scarpa, you know, I mean, you know Scarpa, you know, tons of wines, tons of Library Reserve, Barolo, Barbera, Frese. I mean, I drank the 2001 Dolcetto last night. But it was dusty in a bad way. It wasn't dusty red in a good way. For many years, it was a, in Italian you say a recupero. Like a restoration project. Do you know what I mean? There was a lot of work. It was, I don't know, kind of like my dad. He'd be looking at a, you know, an old Impala, 65 Impala. I hope they made them then. But he could see a 65 Impala, like all rusty with no paint. He'd be like, that's the shit. Like he'd see the gold speckled blue paint and he'd see the Holley 4-barrel carburetor on it, right? Through the hood. You know what I'm saying? I was like, dude, that doesn't even have tires, right? It's on cinder blocks. I bring some of that, I think, to these places, you know, with Scarpa, that was certainly the case. And they did lots of work themselves. So they were already working, I think, for a good 10 years to bring it back up. You know, it was kind of, it was petering out. They had lots of great Library Reserve wines, but they were making less and less wines every year. And I'm super proud of that. Now, you know, it's doing super well and it has a new life. It's a rejuvenated tradition and that's really cool. So, yeah, I think that's finding those producers. You know, I just think they're going to go away, right? So I want to find them, you know, I want other people to be able to experience that.
I guess that sensibility really melds pretty well with Cristiano Garella. You bring in Colombella and Garella and I feel like that's his whole... the job he's set for himself for his entire zone, like for the place that he's from.
For Alto Piemonte. Yeah. I never thought about it that way, but I think you're right. He is someone that, you know, he's a little bit like a gnome, right? And he drives around real quick, picking up different soils and showing them to you. And I think that he really did for Alto Piemonte. He has that love of the land and that area. I mean, it's cool to say Alto Piemonte, and it's kind of, you know, now with buyers and sommeliers, it's the area now. But even going there nowadays, I gotta figure out the back road that doesn't, you know, it doesn't have the industrial wasteland by its side. You know what I mean? It's not beautiful. It's not Tuscany. It's not Friuli. It's an economically depressed area still. You know, even Gattinara, it's hard to find a prosciutto sandwich that's like decent, you know? They got like white bread sandwiches there. But Cristiano has, and he's bringing it back. And he like all great visionaries, he looks beyond the things that aren't working and the desperation and looks at the things that he can make work and does make work.
I feel like the wines are pretty good. Colin Bell and Girl.
I think they're coming along, you know? I mean, it's fun to follow a winery that each year they're getting better and better, you know? That's a really great feeling. I mean, also because you feel like you made a good choice. Also because you feel like you're building something together. So that's really cool. It's a three-person team there. You know, there's Cristiano, who's, you know, the experienced enologist and really the guru of Alto Piemonte for soils and wines and an excellent, excellent taster. And then there's his friend Giacomo Colombera, who's just, you know, kind of young guy, just graduated from agronomy school. And he has the vineyards along with his dad, who's the real gruff guy, Carlo. He was a tractor. Like, just to give you some idea, he was a tractor driver at Antoniolo, right? And he had these vineyards. He made some good wines. They were rustic though, right? They weren't followed so well in the cellar. But the three of them together is such a cool thing to see for the generational shift, right? Because I'll call the house. I'll be like, Cristiano. He's like, no, this is Carlo. Ernest, what are you doing? You know, come stay. I'm like, I'm good, man. I'm good. How are you doing? He's like, fucking kids, you know? All they want to do is like Facebook. I don't understand that Facebook even. And then there's lots of people coming here. I don't even know who they are. Why are they coming here, Ernest? I'm like, well, no, they like the wine. It's a good thing, man. He's like, okay, that's fine. That's fine. But they should work more in the vineyard, you know? They, you know, what are they doing? He's like this huge hulking guy. So it's a good trio. It's one of the things where there's no tension between the generational shift between Cristiano's kind of our age, right? And has lots of experience. And in the middle of his career, kind of, you know, really, really doing fourth gear kind of in his career. And you know, Giacomo is just starting out and learning. And Carlo is, you know, he's got the reverse gear and can like run you over, right? So it's kind of cool.
You see that also at Pepe, like the generations together in a kind of almost seamless way, but they're very different, right?
For sure. I mean, the thing that amazes me about Pepe is lots and lots of wines in their cellar in the South, right? I mean, you just don't see this. You don't see this in the North really a lot, let alone in the South. And they have this naturalness sitting around the dinner table. That really amazes me. And it's really Italian. And it's a good thing that's Italian. You know, when we go out to places in the U.S., young people really don't mix with older people, right? I mean, it just doesn't happen. And in Italy, it does more. And I think that is a context that allows for better understanding of many things, human issues, but also practical ones. You know, what did you do when it was really hot out? Or why aren't we going to do what you did when it was really hot out because of this, right? It's that conversation at the dinner table between multiple generations. And Pepe does that well. They do it really well. And with a naturalness that few producers have. I mean, the 50-year vertical tasting of Pepe was super cool. And I loved to taste all those old wines. And, I was so happy to do it. But one of the cool parts of the tasting, the historic tasting of the Pepe wines, was how like family members were making like their own food and coming between, you know, all these Italian, American, and Canadian world journalists and wine, and like giving me like, you know, spaghetti alla guitarra. Like that's kind of cool, right? I mean, that's a real panache to be able to have that naturalness as a family, but also being a leading winery not only in the South but all of Italy.
Seeing them all lined up that way, the multiple generations at the table.
Right, right.
That was the visit that said, yeah, I think I got to have a kid.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that was the game changer for me.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. It hit me pretty hard. I at least being there.
Yeah. Good for you, man. I mean, that's it's one of the things. It's easy to talk shit about Italy. You know, I live in Italy, and it's easy to get down on Italy. But it still has things to teach us. And one of them is family. And one of them is gather around the dinner table. You know, I was with distributor a couple weeks ago, and you know, he's like, I don't have time to eat dinner. You know, I'm always like woofing it down and stuff. And I get that. And I really appreciate that too. I'm like, I really appreciate your work. But I said, you know, it's in my interest. You work as hard as you can, and I get as much as I can out of you, right? But that's not what I'm looking to do. I hope you can, I'm not saying have a 2-hour lunch, right? But I'm hoping you can take, you know, an hour and sit down with your family and, you know, make, you know, have salad and some beans or whatever, huh? And nothing crazy. But take care of yourself, man. Do that. That's an important pattern. That's an important rhythm. That's a good habit.
What's going to be next for you?
What do you mean?
I mean, here you are. You're just cresting that part where things are starting to get good for you, I think. That's the sense I get. It's all starting to come together. It's working.
Yeah.
Usually in Levy Dalton's life, and I feel like we have a lot of similarities, That's the part where I start fucking things up. You know what I mean? Like, no, that's the part where...
Dude, we're very similar. Yeah, I mean, you know, the murder to create thing, right? I agree. I mean, I'm kind of prepared. You know, I have people around me that don't want me to fuck things up. And so I trust them for me to trust myself. And so I'm hoping it's a little bit different because I am like that. You don't want to have too much success, right? You don't want to be a sellout. You want to be authentic, whatever that means. But being authentic too, Levy, is taking care of the people around you and sitting down at the table and sharing a glass of wine and a plate of pasta.
Ernest Ilfkowitz believes in the power of having people around you. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you, Levy, man.
Ernest Ilfkowitz of Portovino, an importer of Italian wines into America. Thank you.
All Drink to That is hosted and produced by myself, Levy Dalton. Aaron Skella has contributed original pieces. Editorial assistance has been provided by Bill Kimsey. The show music was performed and composed by Rob Moose and Thomas Bartlett. Show artwork by Alicia Tenoyan. T-shirts, sweatshirts, coffee mugs, and so much more, including show stickers, notebooks, and even gift wrap, are available for sale if you check the show website, alldrinktothatpod.com. That's ILLDrinktothatPOD.com, which is the same place you'd go to sign up for our email list or to make one of the crucially important donations that help keep this show operating. You can donate from anywhere using PayPal or Stripe on the show website. Remember to hit subscribe or to follow this show in your favorite podcast app, please. That's super important to see every episode. And thank you for listening.